From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, birth control, abortion, and the right to sexual privacy. We talk with David Garrow, the author of a new history of the reproductive rights movement called Liberty and Sexuality. He's also the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King. Also today, Shirley Taylor Hayslip is black, but her mother's side of the family is very light. In fact, many of her relatives passed for white. Hayslip's new memoir is about tracking down the part of her family that disappeared into the white world. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Blink, the new thriller starring Madeleine Stowe and Aidan Quinn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is promising the nation's governors the federal government will help them fight crime. The National Governors Association is meeting in Washington, D.C., and Mr. Clinton is asking the state leaders to help him in passing a bill that would add 100,000 police officers to the street. The legislation would also put felons who commit three violent crimes behind bars forever.
I want to invite you not only to do whatever you are doing at the state level, but to be involved with us here as we work through this crime bill to make sure that it is well-drawn, well-drafted, and achieves the objectives it is designed to achieve.
The governors are glad that the president wants to help them, but they're telling him the federal government had better not ask them to pay for these giant programs. They told Mr. Clinton Congress can't tell the states what to do and then expect them to pay for it. South Carolina Governor Carol Campbell says state budgets can't take it. The Commerce Department says Americans' personal income rose 4.7% last year. That beats last year's inflation rate of 2.7%. The government also says spending was up 6.1% for the year. Consumer spending makes up two-thirds of the nation's economic activity, and analysts say it was crucial to last year's economic growth rate of 2.9%. At least five Somalis died today when U.S. soldiers fired on a crowd of Somalians. U.S. soldiers, or rather officials, say they were fired on by at least two gunmen first while they were escorting a convoy. Witnesses are disputing this. The BBC's Mark Doyle reports.
The shooting incident occurred on one of the main roads in the center of the city. According to the American diplomat, a convoy of civilian and military vehicles was shot at and Marines returned fire. The diplomat said the American vehicles were hit at least three times by gunfire, although there were no American casualties. He said he believed the Marines hit at least two of the gunmen firing on them. Foreign correspondents in Mogadishu have quoted Somali eyewitnesses on the scene as saying the Americans opened fire before any other shots were heard. One report spoke of a crowd possibly blocking the road and apparently panicking the American troops. A correspondent for the French news agency saw the bodies of three Somalis in the streets, as well as a number of seriously injured people. Other reports said more people had subsequently died of their injuries.
Mark Doyle reporting. North Korea says it might refuse to let nuclear inspectors visit its nuclear facilities if the United States sends Patriot missiles to South Korea. Patriots are defensive missiles that shoot down incoming attack missiles. The Associated Press is quoting an unidentified North Korean official who says the North is prepared either for dialogue or for war. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 32 points at 3,977. This is NPR. An attorney for skater Tanya Harding's ex-husband may make a statement soon. Jeff Gillooly is charged in the alleged plot to attack skater Nancy Kerrigan. He'll appear in court in Portland, Oregon tomorrow. The Oregonian newspaper says he'll plead guilty to racketeering. The report also says Gillooly confessed to planning the attack because Harding got a low ranking at a December skating competition. He reportedly worried she wouldn't do well in the U.S. skating championships. Harding has not been charged in the Kerrigan assault. She is still on the U.S. Olympic team. Northern Irish Protestant politicians are angry that the Clinton administration has decided to let Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams into the United States. Adams is supposed to attend a two-day conference. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from London.
As leader of the Irish Republican Army's political wing, Gerry Adams has been refused entry to the U.S. for the last 20 years, but the White House agreed to allow him in on a highly restricted visa to attend a conference on the Northern Ireland peace process, which he has yet to endorse officially. However, Ken McGuinness, a Protestant member of Parliament from Northern Ireland, today denounced the move and said he will not attend the New York conference with Adams there.
UK's partners in NATO are now more eager to have a terrorist explaining what the situation is in Northern Ireland than bona fide constitutional politicians.
McGuinness and other Protestant leaders say they have information that Adams will announce a temporary IRA ceasefire while in the U.S., which they say will be a propaganda ploy. Adams has denied the rumors. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
French author Pierre Boulle has died. He was 81. Boulle is best known for his works Bridge on the River Kwai and Planet of the Apes. Both novels were made into successful films. Boulle was trained as an engineer before he turned to writing. He received the War Cross from World War II and the Medal of the Resistance. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After writing several books on the civil rights movement, David Garrow has written a history of the reproductive rights movement. Garrow is best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King called Bearing the Cross. His new book, Liberty and Sexuality, is about the right to sexual privacy and the battles surrounding the legalization of contraception and abortion. Garrow's history begins with Connecticut's anti-contraception statute, which was passed in 1879. Contraception was outlawed in Connecticut until 1965, when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that law and guaranteed the right to use birth control. The Connecticut statute forbade obscene literature and any materials concerning sex or reproduction. It outlawed the use of any drug, medicine, article, or instrument for the purpose of preventing conception. You may be surprised to hear who pushed through that bill. It was P.T. Barnum of circus fame, who then chaired the Connecticut Joint Committee on Temperance.
Barnum, in addition to his circus work, was quite active in Connecticut state politics, served 3 terms in the state legislature, was mayor of Bridgeport for several years, and was really sort of the Connecticut representative of Anthony Comstock's anti-obscenity crusade. A number of other states, New York and Massachusetts, in those years passed very similar statutes, but only the Connecticut one expressly outlawed even the use of birth control.
What was the argument against birth control?
Once the battle was really joined in Connecticut in the early 1920s, when Katharine Hepburn Sr., the mother of the well-known actress, first really launched what became Connecticut Planned Parenthood, the opposition forces that Mrs. Hepburn and the other early women's rights activists in Connecticut were up against was primarily the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. By the 1920s and 30s, Connecticut had a significant Catholic population, Irish, Italian, Lithuanian immigrant communities, and the church hierarchy in the state really adopted the anti-birth control law as a political symbol of the power of the Catholic Church and of the church's traditional position, which has continued to the present day, that any use of quote-unquote artificial means of preventing conception is a moral sin. And what's very clear in the Connecticut struggle is the questions of economic class that were so dramatically present there, because even though any use or counseling of birth control was illegal all those years in Connecticut, many women who could afford private physicians were, of course, able to get diaphragm fittings and other particular advice. But what was really prevented by the old Barnum law was any public establishment of birth control clinics for working class or poor women who, in terms of Connecticut's working class immigrant populations, tended to be very disproportionately Roman Catholic. And so from 1939, 1940, on for a quarter century until the Griswold decision in 1965, clinics continued to be prohibited by the criminal law in Connecticut.
Yeah, that Barnum law outlawing contraception stayed on the books until 1965, when it was overturned by the Supreme Court. What was the case that overturned that law?
The case that eventually overturned the old 1879 law was called Griswold versus Connecticut, named after one of the two criminal defendants who were appealing their convictions, Estelle Griswold, who had become head of Connecticut Planned Parenthood in the 1950s, and who was a marvelously energetic character. She indeed had put together a previous case that the U.S. Supreme Court in 1961 had turned aside by a one-vote margin on the grounds that there wasn't any evidence that anybody was in the present day being arrested under the law, even though unbeknownst to the justices during the very months that the case was in the Supreme Court, wholesalers of condoms, for example, were indeed being arrested and convicted in Connecticut. Right after the that 1961 duck by the Supreme Court, Estelle Griswold said, "Well, if the court has claimed that the law, isn't going to be enforced, we'll simply open clinics again." And that is what she did in November of 1961 in New Haven. And much to her great pleasure, she was extremely happy when the two New Haven police detectives arrived. Much to her happiness, she and a colleague, Dr. Lee Buxton from Yale Medical School, were indeed arrested and convicted for counseling women concerning birth control in violation of the old Barnum law.
Why were they happy? They wanted to do a test case and try to overturn the law?
After almost 40 years of, not getting anywhere with the Connecticut State Legislature, they knew very well that they needed actual criminal convictions in order to, really force the courts to face the basic constitutional question of did women and did, medical personnel have a fundamental right to practice and advise on birth control if that was what the women desired.
The Supreme Court overturned the Barnum law, which made contraception illegal. The Supreme Court overturned that law on the grounds that it violated the right to privacy. What was the Supreme Court's reasoning?
The court's primary reasoning in the Griswold decision was that the entire Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution, taken as a whole, inescapably protect fundamental intimate privacy within a family and marriage context, even though, the word privacy by itself doesn't appear in any of the individual amendments. In addition, both the Ninth Amendment and really more importantly, the 14th Amendment in its protection of fundamental individual liberty also were very explicitly cited by the Griswold justices in saying that a law as intrusive to private family reproductive decision making as the outlawing of contraception, that fundamental constitutional values were very deeply and immediately infringed upon by criminalizing birth control.
When the Supreme Court overturned the Barnum law that made contraception illegal in Connecticut, did that help pave the way for Roe v. Wade?
Yes, precisely. Prior to the Griswold Supreme Court decision in 1965, really no one in this country up until that time had really ever articulated abortion in terms of being a right. And it was how the Griswold decision spoke of birth control in the context of being a fundamental right that really intellectually and doctrinally opened the way for young lawyers to quite quickly realize that if a woman's decision with regard to birth control was a fundamental constitutional right, that ergo the argument could also be made that abortion in the context of an unwanted pregnancy could also potentially be viewed as a fundamental constitutional right.
And did Roe v. Wade talk about the right to privacy, the constitutional right to privacy?
Yes, Roe is quite directly based on Griswold, on the right to privacy, and on the very extensive development of Griswold in the abortion context that had taken place in a large number of state and lower federal courts in the years immediately preceding Roe v. Wade. I think one very crucial part of Roe's history that many people nowadays unfortunately aren't familiar with or don't remember is how much courtroom and legislative battling there was over abortion in the 6 or 7 years preceding Roe. Almost every state in America had legislative battles over abortion liberalization. And by 1971, 1972, when Roe v. Wade got to the U.S. Supreme Court, there were very similar abortion rights constitutional cases pending or already on their way up in state or federal courts in 25 to 30 of our 50 states.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Garrow. His new book, Liberty and Sexuality, is a history of the legal battles over the right to contraception and abortion. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Garrow, author of Liberty and Sexuality, The Right to Privacy and the Making of Roe v. Wade. He's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King, Bearing the Cross. In the past few years, there have been a lot of challenges to the right to abortion, and there have been new restrictions on abortion that have been found to be legal by the Supreme Court, restrictions put on by individual states. How strong do you think a woman's right to abortion is right now?
Roe is now completely assured for all time.
Why do you say that?
What the Supreme Court said in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 decision in a case out of Pennsylvania, in that decision, where, you know, much to some people's surprise, the court by a 5-4 margin upheld the core essence of Roe v. Wade, the way in which Justices O'Connor and Kennedy and Souter, the three crucial members of the Casey court, what they said there in a very powerful, really quite dramatically important opinion was that Roe v. Wade is not simply about abortion. It's also about the institutional authority and stature of the Supreme Court. It's about the dependability of American law and constitutional decisions and Americans' ability to rely upon the court, to stand back from the political process. And it was especially dramatic because how those three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, were Reagan-Bush appointees, you know, appointees who ostensibly had been chosen because they would supposedly vote to discard Roe v. Wade.
And they thought that if they backed down on Roe, it would mean that the American public couldn't trust the Supreme Court to uphold its own decisions?
Yes, very much. And the way in which they all three put their names on the one opinion, which is a device, a gesture that is very rare in court history. The last time it was done in that way was back in the late 1950s in Cooper v. Aaron, a case out of Little Rock, where the court, in very similar language to Casey, indicated that Brown v. Board of Education was untouchable. And I think post-Casey that any future nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court to be a credible candidate for confirmation by the U.S. Senate is going to have to indicate support for that O'Connor-Kennedy-Souter position in Casey, just as a nominee has to indicate that she or he supports Griswold and supports Brown v. Board of Ed. What Casey represents is really the final endorsement of Roe v. Wade as something that's not going to change.
The latest Supreme Court decision relating to abortion, and this came down just a few days ago, is that RICO, the federal anti-racketeering law, could be used against anti-abortion activists who conspired to block clinics or to intimidate providers and patients. So how can that change things? How do you expect that will be used?
The RICO decision is first and foremost, particularly because it was unanimous and written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, is a very powerful symbolic indication of how violent and extremist anti-abortion groups are now not only on the defensive, but they're very much in retreat. What I think we're presently seeing is a phase that, in a way, reminds me historically of what we saw in the late 1960s in the South in the civil rights context. A very disproportionate amount of segregationist violence, church burnings, shootings, really came after the 1964 and 1965 civil rights and voting rights acts were in place. When Ku Klux Klan-type violent segregationists essentially realized they had lost. And I think that's where we essentially are now on abortion. Roe v. Wade will continue to exist for all time, and even the Randall Terrys of the world have to face that. And there may, for some number of years, continue to be acts of violence against clinics. But the constitutional stature of Roe v. Wade will be with us forever.
You're confident that the Supreme Court will not renege on Roe v. Wade, that the Supreme Court is not going to turn around and make abortion illegal. On the other hand, what a lot of people who work at abortion clinics now are saying is that legally the right is there, but there aren't doctors willing to perform abortions anymore because of the harassment that doctors who do abortions have been subjected to lately. So do you think that the Supreme Court decision of a few days ago might help change that? What do you see in the future there?
Yes. The basic question for the future is not the constitutional status of abortion, because Roe v. Wade is going to be with us, is guaranteed for all time. The future question on abortion really has to do with access to clinics and with the medical community's interest in providing abortion services. In too many states, some like North Dakota and Mississippi are the most dramatic examples, there are only one or two clinics that offer abortion services in the entire state. Some of that is due to doctors' disinterest in abortion because of the harassment they've received from Operation Rescue. And I think that the biggest challenge for pro-choice forces these next few years is not going to be in the courts, because most of that battle is now over. The real pro-choice effort in these next few years is going to be towards guaranteeing that medical professionals are going to follow through on and provide the sorts of services that Roe v. Wade and the RICO decision give constitutional Supreme Court protection to.
Last year, the Supreme Court upheld state restrictions on the right to abortions, restrictions that require, for instance, young people to get parental permission before getting an abortion, or restrictions that require waiting periods before you can get an abortion. Do you think that those restrictions will be challenged again, or do you think that they're going to stand forever?
I think it's inescapable that both the 24-hour waiting period restriction and some of the limitations on teenagers' access to abortion will indeed be challenged further once some of these state statutes, such as Pennsylvania's and Mississippi's, do take effect and evidence develops concerning what their real-life effects on women are.
How would they be challenged, though, because the Supreme Court already upheld restrictions?
The court upheld those restrictions only in a facial context where there were initial declaratory challenges to those provisions. And particularly Justices O'Connor and Souter have signaled very explicitly 9 or 10 months ago that when these questions come back to the court with a full record of factual evidence of, you know, what impact do waiting periods, for example, have on women's access to abortion, that the justices will look again at the question, to quote the appropriate language from Planned Parenthood v. Casey, of whether something like a 24-hour waiting period is an undue burden or a substantial obstacle to women's fundamental right to choose. And so it indeed is quite possible that the Supreme Court some years from now will indeed strike down on a full record the sorts of limitations that in the Pennsylvania case they declined to strike down at the get-go.
Looking at it historically, do you think that the more militant of the anti-abortion activists connect to any people in the past who had opposed birth control earlier in the history of of this story? Or do you think that, that it's a relatively new phenomenon?
No, I think that the basic animus towards sexuality that we see in many of the anti-abortion activists connects very directly to the attitudes that we can see historically back in the opposition to birth control in the years preceding the Griswold victory. I think what we have here is first and foremost a discomfort with acknowledging how important a role sexuality has in human life. This is not simply an animus towards women or people who are focused on the human fetus. Underlying all of this, stretching all the way back to the early part of this century, across the abortion and birth control debates, is a very deep-seated discomfort with sexuality and with open expressions of sexuality. And I think that that same discomfort or animus is also quite visible in an awful lot of the opposition towards gay Americans and acknowledging their legal status.
David Garrow is the author of Liberty and Sexuality, The Right to Privacy and the Making of Roe v. Wade. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shirley Taylor Hazelip is a black woman, but her skin color is as light as the average white person's. In fact, most of her relatives on her mother's side passed for white. Hazelip's new memoir is about tracking down the part of her family that lived as white. These relatives had cut themselves off from the rest of the family so they could disappear into the white world. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Blink, the new thriller by director Michael Apted, who also directed Coal Miner's Daughter and Gorillas in the Mist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says interest rates are going up. It's just a matter of when. The Fed chairman told Congress this morning that real short-term interest rates are abnormally low.
At some point, absent an unexpected and prolonged weakening of economic activity, we will need to move them to a more neutral stance. Such an action would not be taken in order to cut off or limit the economic expansion, but rather to sustain and enhance it.
The central bank's policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee will meet this Thursday and Friday. They'll chart economic policy in the near term. Republican governors who met with President Clinton today say he is willing to compromise on two key points in his health care plan. They say Mr. Clinton says he's flexible on limiting health spending and on the idea of making regional health alliances mandatory. The GOP objects to both, but they say Mr. Clinton is still firm on covering all Americans. The president has vowed to veto any health care package that doesn't have universal coverage in it. The chairman of the Senate Committee on Aging is disputing claims by the pharmaceutical industry that it is doing a good job on holding down price increases. NPR's Carolyn Clark Kelly has more.
Democrat David Pryor says it all depends on how you look at the numbers. The pharmaceutical industry says it's made radical changes and has brought the rate of price increases for drugs down to about 3%. Senator Pryor points out that this is still 15 times higher than the overall rate of inflation for manufacturers. Pryor says unless the drug companies voluntarily agree to do more, then Congress is ready to act.
The stick is to reduce their patent protection. The stick is to not allow them to continue to write off their taxes and charge the American taxpayer with development.
Pryor says he may also introduce a bill that would shorten federal patent protections for companies with excessive price increases. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
President Clinton and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl have met today at the White House. The Clinton administration is trying to put together a plan to end the Bosnian War. The president's meeting with Kohl and with the British foreign minister later this week could be the last diplomatic efforts to settle the Bosnian War. The government says Americans' personal income rose 4.7% in 1993. That's higher than the inflation rate, but it is still not as good as the 1992 rate of 6.1%. Income was up 0.6% in December. Personal income is the amount of money that people make from different sources. Stock prices closed at yet another record high today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 33 points to end at 3,978.36. Advances led declines by 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The countdown is underway for the first space shuttle mission of 1994. The shuttle Discovery is scheduled for a historic morning liftoff. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
For the first time in the program's 13-year history, a Russian cosmonaut will fly aboard the space shuttle. Sergei Krikalev gained notoriety when he became stuck in space as Soviet communism was dismantling below. When he finally did return, the name of his hometown had been changed from Leningrad back to St. Petersburg. Krikalev will join five U.S. astronauts on an 8-day mission. The countdown clock began ticking early this morning and will lead up to a planned liftoff at 7:10 Eastern Time Thursday morning. NASA is hoping to continue the momentum generated by a highly successful Hubble repair mission last December. The presence of a Russian cosmonaut during this flight is sure to keep a high profile for the agency as it heads into another budget battle in Congress. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The leader of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, is en route to the United States. Gerry Adams was given a visa by the Clinton administration after deliberations that included President Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher. Adams first had to declare his opposition to violence against innocent civilians. His visa is good for only 48 hours, and it lets him attend a private New York conference on Northern Ireland. He can't go more than 25 miles from New York, and he can't fundraise while he's here. PLO leader Yasser Arafat says he'll meet Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres next week in Egypt. The two plan to conclude the Palestinian self-rule agreement. Both sides announced a breakthrough in their negotiations over the weekend. They were working to settle differences on security matters and the size of Jericho. The West Bank town, along with Gaza, will be governed by Palestinians in the autonomy agreement. The Associated Press is quoting sources as saying some technical border crossing matters must still be settled. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Shirley Taylor Hayslip is black, but she says many people would never know it. Her skin is as light as that of an average white person. But she says her psyche, soul, and sensibility are black. Most of her relatives on her mother's side of the family passed for white. To live as white, they dissociated themselves from their extended family. Hayslip's new memoir, The Sweeter the Juice, is about how and why she tracked down the part of her family that disappeared into the white world. Hayslip's mother, Margaret, was brought up by darker-skinned relatives after she was abandoned by her own family at the age of 4. That year, Margaret's mother died. Margaret's father was an alcoholic. He didn't want the responsibility of raising a child, and neither did the older children in the family. I asked Shirley Taylor Hayslip why it was so important for her to track down the members of her family who had passed for white.
I wanted to do something very special for my mother for her 80th birthday, and their absence had haunted me as it had haunted her all of her life, and I wanted to give her a sense of closure and some sense of what had happened in her family and why they had disappeared, because we knew nothing, and I felt it was important for her, important for me, and important for my children to know something about the other side of our family.
You say that that their disappearance haunted you. What haunted you about it?
Well, I had on one side a very full, robust clan of wonderful black, dark-skinned people. And on the other side, there was nothing. I had no way to compare who I looked like, what I might have inherited from them, and what genes might have been transmitted to me. And I knew that it was something that was very sorrowful for my mother, and I think I probably absorbed some of her sorrow at a very early age.
Did you always know that your mother's family passed for white?
I knew from early on, but I understood it at different levels according to how old I was. I knew that she had a father, and he was my grandfather, and I knew he was living, and she just said he was being a white man. And when I first heard that, I didn't quite understand what it meant. And I understood it as I grew older. But I knew the family had all left the race, so to speak.
I suppose even if you knew how to find them, that they might not have wanted you to visit them because the other part of your family, because it would have given away their secret.
Well, yes and no. This is a very common occurrence. What happened in our family was very common in African-American families in America. What's uncommon about the story is the search and the recovery. So many people passed for white, and many did stay in contact with their black families, even if by phone or by letter or by pre-arrangement. And that was part of my mother's sorrow, because she knew many other families who had white relatives. They knew where they were, and they kept up with them. And it was a secret within a secret, but they did stay in touch, but not this particular family.
Were you able to find out exactly why the members of your mother's family wanted to live as white people?
No, the problem is all of them except my mother's sister are dead. So a lot of it is speculation based on what happened during that time period. It was a depression, and racism was rampant. They were living between two races. And I'm fairly certain they made the choice for economic and social reasons, believing that the privilege of white skin would take them out of the problems of being black in America at that time.
Do you think that they were worried about having children because the children might be blacker than they were?
Yes, I'm sure they were. I'm fairly certain. There were two aunts and uncles who had no children. And it was said in the family they were concerned that the children might be dark.
You know, it's interesting. Your family, your father's side of the family is this really prominent African American family. And, you know, although so many people on your mother's side passed as white, on your father's side, your father was a pastor. He formed the local chapter of the NAACP. He headed that chapter for 35 years. He integrated the local Y. He was a prosperous man. He owned property from Washington to Maine. And as you say, your father wanted his family to be, quote, exemplary Negroes.
Right. Well, of course, that, you know, was the language of the time. But his father, too, had been a prominent man, and that's how he was raised, and he was raised to be a leader, and he wanted his children to exercise leadership roles and to help galvanize and change the community. So we were brought up to see ourselves as change agents.
So it must have particularly mystified you. Why, while you were living in this family that was so proud of being black and so at the forefront of community work, to on the other hand have this part of the family that just left
yes,
the race.
Yes, that's exactly right. But you see, they lived in different places and under different circumstances.
Mm-hmm,
and
my
father's family was just fortunate enough and worked hard enough to be able to become privileged and do well. And so that it sort of turns American stereotypes on their head, because the family that chose to be white, thinking it would get the advantage that whiteness brings in this country, did not exactly fulfill those dreams. Whereas the black family, which had to struggle against all of the tides of racism in the country, did fairly well.
My guest is Shirley Taylor Hayslip. Her new memoir is called The Sweeter the Juice, a family memoir in black and white. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Shirley Taylor Hayslip. So when you decided that you wanted to track down your surviving aunt who passed as white, you hired a private detective, and the private detective found her in Anaheim.
Anaheim, California. And I said, how perfect, the land of Disney World.
Yeah.
But you see, I didn't know who existed. I mean, I didn't know whether the aunt was still living or the uncles or the cousins, but we found that she was still living.
Mm-hmm.
And then she became the Rosetta Stone, so to speak, to opening the doors and discovering the rest of the family, because she, on her side, and my mother's white side, she knew where they were and she had stayed in touch with them.
So once you found out her address, you were living in Los Angeles.
That's right.
You showed up at her door.
Right. Unannounced.
With a bouquet of flowers.
Right.
And what did you say to her?
Well, as you can imagine, I was in turmoil because I had heard about this woman all of my life. I didn't know what she looked like. And I had mixed feelings of anger and fright. I thought perhaps I would be rejected as my mother had been. And I was terribly curious. So at the moment I arrived, I rang the bell. And out of the gloom comes a little woman who looked like my mother. And that startled me. I don't know what I expected her to look like, but I'd never seen anybody who looked like my mother. And she smiled at me and she said, who would you like? I said, I have flowers for Mrs. Kramer. And she said, I'm Mrs. Kramer. Who are the flowers from? And at that point, my throat almost closed up. But I said, they're from your sister Margaret and me, your niece Shirley. She took the flowers, and a look went across her face that I couldn't read because I didn't know her. But then she composed herself, and she said, well, come in. And from that point, we began a dialogue. And I had to be very gentle and delicate with her because she was nearing 90, and here I was, a visible evidence of a past that she had repressed or rejected or denied or hid or whatever.
Has she been able to tell friends that she's from a black family?
I don't think she's told any friends yet. It was very difficult for her to tell her own family.
Family didn't know.
No, see, she all of the siblings married white, and they never told the people they married they had black heritage. And then they had children, and the children did not know. So she had one daughter, whom I never met because the daughter died, unfortunately. But the daughter then had three children, and I knew those three children were living near her in Anaheim. And she, over the course of the year, was not able to tell them. And I didn't want to tell them. I didn't think it was my place. But ultimately, I was in contact with one after she told me he was coming east to look for information about his family.
In your book, you write that your aunt could not give up being white. And you say that she didn't exactly pass for white. She became white.
Yes, I deliberately chose that word because I want the reader to think about that. If you live white, you marry white, you go to church white, you assume a white point of view, are you not white? And what does being white or what does being black mean? No one in her world knew she was not white. So, and I carefully researched the laws now of the country. There's nothing that legally defines blackness anymore. Since 1983, the last law was struck down. So I suggest that, you know, race in many cases can indeed simply be a matter of context or self-definition. And in her case, and in the case of literally hundreds of thousands of other black Americans who have passed over, they have become white, I suggest.
You've obviously become very interested in your whole family.
Yes.
Your mother's side, your father's side, including the part of your family that passed for white and the part of your family that was white.
Right.
How has it changed your sense of yourself to find out as much as you have?
I think it's added, and I think it's made me much more tolerant. I always thought of myself as a tolerant person anyway, but I had only defined myself as an African-American, or when it was more fashionable as black, or as a Negro, or as colored. You know, we went through all of that. But now, if someone said to me, well, what are you? I would say, socially, I am a black person, but I have roots in many gardens. In this country, many ethnic people marry other ethnic people. And when you say to them, what's your nationality? They might say, I'm Russian and Czechoslovakian, or I'm Italian and Irish. So why shouldn't other people be able to say they're this and they're that? Why should they be forced only into one category?
It's interesting what you said, how you described yourself as socially a black person.
Yes. Well, I think there is a black psyche, and I believe there is a white psyche based on the experiences that we have. And blacks generally, I think, have a double consciousness because we have to go through life in two worlds. But you could go into a store, perhaps, and not worry about whether someone would cash your check or whether somebody would follow you around if you have light skin or if you're a white person, whereas a black person is always concerned about the possibility of rejection or negative encounters, and that becomes part of our psyche. We have these antennae out, not that we're looking for trouble or confrontation, but we know that the potential for danger or harassment or rejection is just there. And so that becomes a permanent part of our psyche. It becomes part of that well of rage that I mentioned and that so many other authors have mentioned that most black people walk around with.
So did you ever have contempt, and do you have any contempt now for people who were from black families but were light and lived as white people?
No, I would say my feeling was more sorrow, and not at them, but at the conditions of the country which forced them to make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be judgmental about what they decided to do because they did it for their own reasons, to survive or to have a better life. It's not a choice that I would have agreed with, and certainly it caused great sorrow in our family. But my sorrow has more to do with, or contempt has to do with, racism in the country and the need for people to escape who they are, to become someone else, to be comfortable.
This research started in part as a birthday gift to your mother for her 80th birthday. You wanted to, if you could, reunite her with a member of the family that had disappeared. And so you managed to do that. What was your mother's reaction? Was she excited?
She was excited. She was sad. She was angry. She thought about all that old hurt. You know, all those old feelings resurfaced again. But I think most of all, the overriding feeling was, I'm finally going to meet my sister. This little girl I dreamed about, this little girl I used to walk down the streets of Washington to see, this little girl I used to cut out pictures of in magazines and say, I wonder if my sister looks like that. And so she realized a lifelong dream. And you see, she had three daughters and a son, and we were all close. And she often said, gee, I really wished I could have been close to my sister like my children are close to each other. So for her, it was the realization of a dream. Now, it wasn't the most perfect dream because, you know, so much time had passed, and really they were strangers and they had lived different lives. And yet, family transcended race. She found her sister.
Were you there when your mother and her sister met?
Oh, yes, because I had been meeting with my aunt for the year, and so she knew me, and she felt comfortable with me, and I knew that I couldn't thrust my mother onto her without some kind of a physical nurturance. And so I was there, but I tried to stay in the background, and I was very touched and very moved by what I saw.
What did they talk about?
Well, they both love cats, and so the cat in the house broke the ice. And they both have daughters named Patricia. Isn't that amazing? And they both have grandsons named Jeffrey. So they talked about their cats and their daughter and their grandchildren. You know, the things that sisters talk about.
But they didn't talk about race.
Oh, no. You see, one of the wonderful things we found out was that when the family dissolved and when the sister left, she was only a little girl, too. So when my mother asked her, well, you know, do you know why our father left and why the family broke up? She said something that was very poignant. And she said, well, I don't know, because I was just a little girl, too.
So does your aunt think of herself as having been brought up white as opposed to having made the decision to pass?
I think that's an interesting question, and I don't know whether she could articulate that. I think she has repressed a lot of her memories, and I think she became white both on a conscious and an unconscious level.
But, I mean, she wasn't unaware, was she, of the fact that she's from a black family?
No, she wasn't.
Predominantly black
family.
No,
she wasn't unaware of it, but what I'm saying is I think she submerged it. I think she repressed.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Shirley Taylor Hayslip is the author of The Sweeter the Juice, a family memoir in black and white. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news of the visit to the United States of Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin member of the British Parliament. That's the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. His visit has occasioned some interesting comment. We'll also be hearing about a firefight in Mogadishu involving American troops and news of the meetings between Israel's foreign minister, Shimon Peres, and PLO chairman Yasser Arafat. Those talks seem to be pointing the way toward implementation of the statement of principles that was signed last September. And we'll have a report about Israeli troops on patrol in Gaza, what duty in the Gaza Strip is like for Israelis.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The English director Michael Apted has spent his career making all kinds of films, from prestigious star vehicles like Coal Miner's Daughter and Gorillas in the Mist, to low-rent comedies like Critical Condition and Spies Like Us, to the acclaimed 7-Up series of British documentaries. His new movie is the thriller Blink. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Among connoisseurs of the thriller, the 1967 movie Wait Until Dark holds a special place, not because it's particularly subtle or literate, just because it's so scary. And what makes it scary, of course, is the beautiful heroine. Not only is she delicate and vulnerable because she's played by Audrey Hepburn, she's also blind, which gives her an extra layer of defenselessness. The idea behind Blink is a clever variation on that theme. This movie's heroine, Emma, played by Madeleine Stowe, has been blind since she was 8 years old. But instead of being a fragile blossom, she's downright ferocious. Emma's a lusty, hard-drinking violin player in a Chicago-Irish bar band. She's been around, and she's learned how to handle herself. Now, unexpectedly, her doctor calls. He's found a cornea donor for her, and he can restore her sight, which he does, but with one or two glitches. For one thing, everything she sees is distorted and unreliable, and for another, she suffers from a so-called perceptual delay. Sometimes her brain won't process what her eyes are taking in for several hours, which means that she'll suddenly find herself seeing something or somebody who isn't there now but was the day before. All of which gets a lot spookier when she hears a woman being murdered in the apartment above hers, and the next morning her brain registers the face of the killer, whom she didn't realize she'd seen escape. When she tells her story to the detective played by Aidan Quinn, all he and his fellow officers can do is sip a cup of Joe and smirk.
Now, let me get this straight. I'm a little bit confused here. You heard some suspicious noises upstairs, and you hear this guy coming down the stairs. You look out, and you spoke to him. That was last night, but you didn't see it till this morning?
That's right, yeah.
So what is that? I mean, your eyes are driving the train, and your brain's the caboose that hasn't caught up yet?
I guess you could say that, yeah.
So your eyes are having a delayed reaction to reality?
I don't know how to explain this. It's something that happens with some people who've had this kind of surgery, but we're a little off track. I came here to tell you that I think something's really gone wrong.
Oh, okay, it's all right. Okay.
Thank you.
How long were you blind?
Are there any cops around here who work, or do you all just sit around and drink coffee?
Naturally, Stowe and Quinn are scheduled to fall in love, but first we expect some heavy jolts, and unfortunately, they never come. Apted and his special effects people create spooky, Francis Bacon-like effects to show the way the world looks to our poor heroine, but once the perceptual delay device is established, Apted doesn't know what to do with it. And the screenplay fritters away the goodwill it's built up by concentrating on Stowe and Quinn's lovers' spats instead of on developing the premise. Still, Aidan Quinn proves once again that he can be very affable, if not very intense, company for 2 hours, and Madeline Stowe does more than that. She's been growing with every picture she's been in, and if you remember how flat she was in movies like Stakeout and Unlawful Entry, it's amazing to watch the fire and insinuation she can pack into a trashy role like this one. Maybe it's time for her to be a little more selective about the parts she takes on. The next really good one is going to make her a major star.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Some people are already asking the question, who lost Russia? Is Russia giving up on democracy and a market economy? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with William Taubman, a political science professor at Amherst College and the author of several books on the Soviet Union. He just returned from his latest trip to Russia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.